1420 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump agreed to debates on June 27th and September 10th. Political analyst Larry Sabato.
The idea of early debates is really a good one because people start voting now in late September for early mail-in and in-person voting.
When it comes to U.S. election security, National Intelligence Director Avril Haines tells the Senate Intelligence Committee Russia is very active.
Russia relies on a vast multimedia influence apparatus, which consists of its intelligence services, cyber actors, state media, proxies, and social media trolls.
A span of bridge connecting Galveston, Texas to Pelican Island tumbled on top of a barge that struck it and shut down a stretch of waterway so crews could clean up an oil spill. Galveston County Judge Mark Henry says of plans to start construction of a new bridge next year.
The reduction of the ability of the bridge is not surprising to anyone. We did not anticipate this accident today, though, of course, accelerating what's going to happen.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Listen to Mornings with WFHR tomorrow during the 9 o'clock hour for Pet of the Week, brought to you by the South Oconee Humane Society, exclusively on locally grown radio.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. There'll be two special elections in Wisconsin this year to fill vacant seats. One of them will be for state Senate in Milwaukee in July. The other will be for U.S. House in Northeast Wisconsin in November. The winners will replace Lena Taylor and Mike Gallagher. Governor Evers announced the dates this week. Wisconsin is waiting to see how the state Supreme Court rules on allowing absentee ballot drop boxes this year. Janelle Ludwig Krause is a voting advocate in western Wisconsin. She says all kinds of voters vote absentee.
Farmers who need to be on their field when the conditions are dry, it makes it possible for parents that are juggling a million things to cast a ballot, for people with disabilities, for elderly people.
Opponents say it's too easy to use drop boxes to commit voter fraud. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The morning show on WFHR. It's dangerous.
6% of our fellow Americans think that they could beat up a grizzly bear.
What? Oh, come on now.
I wouldn't fight Yogi Bear.
Hey, boo-boo. This guy's starting something. What's up?
Gonna take him out.
Don't come for the king unless you visit. Best not miss. Best not miss if you come for the king.
Weekdays from 8 to 10 on WFHR Locally Grown Radio.
You're listening to Locally Grown Radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What an interesting Tuesday we had. President Biden from the Rose Garden came out with some new tariffs, about $18 billion of tariffs on Chinese imports, everything from EVs to solar panels, steel to aluminum, semiconductors to advanced batteries, critical minerals to solar to medical products. Seems we're about ready to start fighting the good fight. As he pointed out in his speech, American workers can outwork and outcompete anyone as long as the competition is fair. And as he points out, look, for too long, it hasn't been fair. It's not competition, he says. It's cheating. And they've been cheating for a while. And the reason they've been getting away with it is corporate America has been lining their pockets in enormous ways, and funneling it back to politicians on all sides of the aisle. We're finally at the breaking point of going, we got to stop. There's going to be nothing left. So good on President Biden for this. It's going to be interesting to watch the business community lose their mind, or maybe they're on board now when they realize they really screwed up. And they screwed up in the long term. Short term, made tons of money. Lined their pockets very well, thank you very much. Got to screw all those workers out of wages. So in the aggregate, corporate America is going to be just fine because we, the taxpayers, are going to have to bail them out. We always do. You know, capitalism, cutthroat capitalism for workers, you know, a little little socialism for corporate America, because we always bail them out. And we have to, because we need the jobs. You know, ultimately, we do need corporations for workers to be able to make a living. But we do need to regulate them. And this is where I keep coming back to. You need guardrails on capitalism, because it does what we're living through. But good on Biden for that. We'll see what the blowback is. The Trump camp, they're tied up in their own problems. And it's interesting watching all of the Republicans flock to Trump's side while he sleeps through his trials. And I got to tell you, I'm thinking the lawyers are drugging him. It's the only way to keep his mouth shut is while he's sleeping and keeping him out of trouble. I'm not advocating for drugging him, but I might get it. But what's interesting is you're watching all of these Republicans making the pilgrimage, kissing the ring, and then going out and doing their press conference to bash the judge's daughter. Mike Johnson was the latest to get down there and kiss Trump's ring and, of course, attack the judge's daughter, the Speaker of the House. How bad is the Republican Party right now? How deep are they into Trump? What does he have on them? I can't imagine a speaker going and doing this kind of stuff prior to right now. Now, get it. You know, Trump did stop Johnson from losing his job. Kind of get it. But what is it? And Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, was on Newsmax, and he admitted that one of the reasons that he went to New York City, reason he went down there to kiss the ring, was the gag order. He was going to overcome that gag order. He was going to say it what it is. And what we find out, in what we've been finding out in the trial, is, you know, Trump World had a New York Times reporter in their pocket who basically, according to them, just kind of, according to what's come out in the trial, just basically wrote whatever they wanted. Am I surprised? Not even a little bit. These folks understand how to manipulate the game. So what you've got is you've got a Republican Party now in the pocket, going down, doing Trump's bidding out in the streets, making the attacks. I got to tell you, it's unprecedented in my view to see this kind of blind faith loyalty. Someone accused of some interesting crimes. Very, very strange. Now, big news this week for me anyway, the workers at Mercedes in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, they are going to the polls to vote whether or not they want to be represented by the UAW. All indications tell me it's going to be close. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I hope everyone's wrong in the it could be close. And it's a blowout like it was in Chattanooga, Tennessee, with the Volkswagen workers. That's the hope. But Mercedes evidently put up a good anti-union campaign. Because, you know, now, as of Tuesday, thanks to Kay Ivey, the governor of Alabama, it's now the law of Alabama to union bust. She signed a law, evidently, that says, you know, we're going to slash your funding if you don't union bust. If you recognize the union without a secret ballot election, you know, nothing. And then we saw this in Georgia. We've seen this pop up in other Republican states. And it got me thinking, you know, they're passing this thing saying, hey, if you don't harass your employees, if you don't go through this whole union busting charade and this activity, we're not going to give you any state money. And it got me thinking, you know, the job of the federal government by law is to encourage collective bargaining. That's what the National Labor Relations Act was all about. It was about the government helping to promote collective bargaining, getting workers and employers together to you know, solve their problems locally, so you didn't have to have big federal regulations. This is where the smaller, less intrusive government crowd gets me. I don't want government imposing things. I do want negotiations. I do want parties sitting down and hammering out an agreement. But, you know, we've got our Republican friends who don't want that. They want dictatorial control. They want, you know, again, these are the people who tell us they want smaller, less intrusive government, but they want government stepping in saying, you can't come to an agreement, you employers and you workers. You can't do this without there being certain barriers that we approve of. So it got me thinking, if this is what the states are going to do, no state money for you if you don't harass your employees. The federal government, as I said, their mission by law is to encourage collective bargaining. So I'm of the mindset that maybe now what we need to do and what Biden needs to do, maybe through executive order, say, look, you know what? We're going to cut your highway funding. We're going to cut your federal highway funding if you union, if you force these laws. If you have these laws on the books, we're just going to cut your federal funding. You want to hear states like Alabama, who heavily dependent on federal government money. You want to hear them squeal? This is where, again, Democrats need to learn to play the game, much like Republicans. Okay, if this is what you want to do, we're going to have to go the other way, because the federal government's job is to promote and encourage collective bargaining. Again, we want people solving problems. But it's interesting to me that the day the vote starts at Mercedes-Benz in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and you guys and women down there who are voting right now, by all means, think about your future. I know they've hired pastors and they've hired all kinds of leaders to come in and say, no, it's better when you just go right to the company and you individually, yeah, it's much better. No, it's not. And they go through all of this, you know, what they're telling you, you know, that they can't guarantee. No, they can't. Unions can't guarantee. But when workers come together en masse and say that they want something, they have the ability to fight much, much more efficiently and win much more often than just individuals going in and pleading. So for me, when you go to the polls, you vote yes, and you get involved in your union because it's your coworkers, and you push for your demands. Because I find it interesting that these Republican states are all on board with denying workers the ability to collectively bargain. And this, I watched this speech by this pastor. Evidently, Mercedes-Benz found themselves a black pastor who he rambled on for about 2.5 minutes about how Mercedes-Benz made people like him, you know, look better, help the community, and a lot of those kind of platitudes that you see thrown out quite often. And some of it's true. Look, you know, they did help the community. They did bring jobs in. They did help, you know, the local economy, and that's great. But they benefited too, wildly. And the work that these workers do create that wealth. So as I talked about yesterday, the reality is, for me anyway, sitting down with the employer and going, what is my labor worth? How much do I produce? Because if I weren't producing more than you're paying me, you wouldn't be hiring me. So how much more am I producing? And I would like a piece of that so that I can clearly support my family, put food on the table, help my local community, all of that stuff. And look, the local community should be on board. The pastors should be on board. Because, and look, I remember a time when the religious community was all in on workers joining unions because it meant higher wages. And what do higher wages mean? It means people are going to be a little more generous in the till. They're going to put a little more money in the collection plate. They're going to tithe that a little bit more dollars. It's going to be the folding stuff and not the jingling stuff. So it's interesting to have a pastor out there go, no, just you can deal directly with the company. Yeah, the union and their committee of workers can deal directly in mass, in power, in the power of numbers with the company. Yeah, I agree. But you know, they're gonna pull out all the stops and they're gonna do everything that they can possibly do to ensure that, well, working people don't get a fair shake. So for me, Mercedes workers down in Tuscaloosa, this is your chance. Don't let it go by. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So in this era of inflation, because all we hear from people is, you know, inflation's killing us. And, you know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. Yeah, inflation went crazy in the 70s. But you know what else? What else happened? Their wages kept up with inflation because, well, they had union contracts with cost of living adjustments. And, you know, so as inflation went up, prices went up, their wages went up. So what should we be doing? Yeah, we should be raising wages, and the minimum wage being one of those things that we haven't raised in I've lost track 14 years now, still at $7.25 nationally. Maybe we need to start doing a lot more on that. I know there are states that have got ballot initiatives that are pushing stuff forward. There are all kinds of great stuff going on. It's because they're organizing on the ground. And that's why I've asked our friend Saru Yaraman to come talk with us. She's the president of One Fair Wage, their website, onefairwage.com. Saru, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I hear this every day. You know, inflation's going through the roof. You know, we're struggling under this inflation. And I go, well, the path forward is better wages. We make more money for the time that we spend working. Seems simple, kind of, to me.
Not just simple, but I think we've reached a moment. We've been saying that for decades, you and I and many others, but I think we've reached an inflection point where so many millions of workers coming out of the pandemic said, you know what? You haven't been hearing us all this time that we need to be paid more. We're just going to leave. I mean, millions of workers walked off the job. In the restaurant industry, which I've been organizing in, 1.2 million workers left the industry citing low wages. And that forced employers in the marketplace to have to raise wages to recruit staff. What we need now is for policymakers who've been so behind, even the marketplace on this issue, to institutionalize the wage gains that workers have been winning and then demanding in the marketplace since the pandemic.
No, and I look at what California is doing. I mean, you know, the fact that they've actually, you've got a council now that deals with issues in the fast food industry, a $20 minimum wage. Those are steps, I think, in the right direction, something maybe, you know, other states could look towards.
Yeah, in fact, even on that, we're now calling for 20 for all, because it's not just fast food workers who need a $20 wage. The minimum wage in California is still $16.50 in the most expensive state in the country. So we really need that $20 wage for everybody in the state. And actually, ahead of us, some cities in Washington state have passed above $20 minimum wages for everybody in the city. So Renton, Washington, and Tukwila, Washington, have both passed 20 for all in those cities. And that's what we need, frankly, not just in California, but across the country.
But what do you say to the person, Saru, who goes, well, why don't you make it $50 an hour? And you know, I've had some of those outrageous statements, but what do you say to that person?
Look, what people are asking for right now, and frankly demanding to be able to stay in these jobs, is frankly enough to cover the cost of living. And that's a pretty simple calculation, not simple, but pretty accessible calculation. So the MIT Living Wage Calculator, you can go on it right now for any county in the United States. It will tell you the minimum you need to earn to cover the basics, housing, food, transportation, not taking your family to Disneyland or Europe, but just actually being able to cover the basic costs of living. And the cheapest county in the United States right now is McClellan County, Texas. Even in McClellan, people need closer to $20 an hour if you have a child to cover those basic costs of living. And so if in the cheapest county in the United States, we're well above 15, we know that right now we need to be pushing for wages across the country that get us closer to the cost of living and also end those horrible subminimum wages for tipped workers, workers with disabilities, youth, incarcerated workers. What we are calling for is a living wage for all. Anybody who works in the United States should receive a minimum wage that covers their basic cost of living.
It seems reasonable, but you know, I see on social media a whole bunch of these memes of, you know, back in the old days, our grandparents, they were able to work for one wage. And, you know, without making this connection that, you know, workers back then had a lot of bargaining power. Unions were very strong. Legislatively, people were pushing for, you know, for higher minimum wages. We haven't had a minimum wage increase nationally in what, 14 years?
That's right, 15 years.
Yeah. And 15 years. We're heading towards that now. So for me, this argument about inflation should be an argument about wages, because guess what? We've had our wages eroded by inflation for the last 40 years because wages just haven't kept up. So for those people who are complaining now, I ask the question, where have you been?
Exactly. I mean, wages back in the day were closer to covering the cost of living, and they just aren't now. And it's purely political. It is not a nature of business or marketplace. Because if it were, we would be following the way businesses have had to raise wages, as I said, post-pandemic. We've seen restaurants in Texas offering $25 an hour that used to offer $2 an hour. I saw an Applebee's in Quakertown, Pennsylvania, offering $20 an hour when Pennsylvania allows workers to be paid $2.83. So clearly, employers are having to provide wages that allow workers to cover the basic cost of living, frankly, to even make it worth it to get to work. Because when you have a wage of $2 or $3 or $4, and the cost of gas is $5 an hour, and the cost of eggs is $5 or $6 an hour, you're just not going to spend more to get to work than you earn when you get there. And so now employers are having to raise wages to cover the cost of living. And that is why so many voters this year, particularly young voters, Black voters, Latinx voters, have named the rising cost of living and jobs with living wages as their top 2024 electoral priorities that are going to determine whether they show up to vote this year and who they vote for. And that's why we're putting these issues directly on the ballot this November in battleground states.
And you've got a number of them, Michigan, Ohio, Arizona, and others. And is this specifically to raise the wage, to do the work, or is this about ensuring that people come out to vote for politicians who are going to do this on a bigger scale as well?
All of the above. People need an immediate raise. So in Michigan, the wage is still $3.75 for restaurant workers and $9 for all other workers. We have an initiative on the ballot to raise it to 15 plus tips for all workers, including tipped workers, workers with disabilities, and youth. In Ohio, the wage is just over $5 an hour, 10 for everybody else, 5 for tipped, 10 for non-tipped. We're raising it to 15 for everybody plus tips, including tipped workers with disabilities and youth. And in Arizona, we're raising it to $18 an hour plus tips. So we are putting it on the ballot in battleground states. We will be raising wages for 3.5 million workers and mobilizing a couple hundred thousand people to go vote themselves a raise. But you're absolutely right. What people are expecting of their candidates, of their electeds this November, is that they're going to keep pushing for wages that actually get us closer to the cost of living at the federal level as well.
But this again, for me, comes back to, you know, voting our own interests. And sadly, for too long, look, I know tons of people who vote on issues that have nothing to do with them. And this seems to me to be one of those things where kitchen table economic stuff is where I spend most of my time. I'm a union guy. I want better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, empowerment for working people. That's one of my main issues. And I don't know that a lot of voters are in that place yet. Or am I not seeing that?
You think a lot of voters are not focused on kitchen table issues? I will say that all of the polls I've seen, look, President Biden is in trouble with some key populations. Young people, number one. Young people are pissed and not going to show up. Or they're largely saying we're pissed and we're not really that excited to show up this November. Black voters and Latinx voters, same thing. And national polls of young people, Black voters and Latinx voters, all have rising cost of living and jobs with living wages as the top issue. So the frustration I'm feeling is not that voters don't see it. It's that the candidates are not speaking about these issues. The candidates seem to be talking about a whole host of other things. President Biden and the Biden-Harris campaign seem to be very focused on what they accomplished over the last 4 years, which is great. You definitely want to talk about what you've done, but you have to acknowledge people are struggling right now. People are suffering right now. And so the message should be, we hear you. We know that the rising cost of living and jobs with living wages are your top issues. Not only have we done a few things to address this, but we know we have to keep at it. So reelect us to get the job done. And by the way, you can go vote yourself a raise this year if you're in Michigan, Ohio, or Arizona. So there's some immediate needs that we need to address on the ballot this year, but there's also a real need for our electeds to speak to our electeds and the candidates who are running this year to speak to the thing that the key populations we are most worried about not turning out this year are saying is their top need and concern. So I have to tell you, abortion is so important. Climate change is so important. But look at these polls. Those issues are not the top issues this year. We have to address what people are saying is their top issue, which is my ability to pay the rent and cover the gas.
No, and I'm with you 100%. But what do you say to the argument? Because I've had a lot of my Democratic friends say, well, look, you know, unemployment's down for all of the communities you talked about. Wages are rising. We're heading in the right direction.
It's so funny because, as you know, President Biden was on CNN a few nights ago and was asked this very question, you know, what about the economy? Voters seem to be pretty dissatisfied with the economy. And his response was, well, we fixed it. And, you know, referring to GDP and unemployment numbers and many of the things that you just referred to. And look at what we did with the infrastructure bill and look at what we've done with student debt relief. All of which is important. I am not denying any of it. But again, we have to acknowledge where people are at. And when people say the economy is my top concern, they don't mean I want to see GDP numbers high and unemployment numbers low. That's not what most normal people are talking about when they say the economy is my top concern. It feels like there's a disconnect in what we mean by economy.
Yeah.
When President Biden talks about economy, he's talking about these macro numbers. When the normal working person says the economy is my top concern, they mean my ability to pay the rent, my ability to cover gas. I mean, Rick, there was that horrific story that just came out this past week of a 34-year-old woman who's been living on top of a grocery store in Detroit, Michigan, in a sign, the grocery store sign. She had been taking electricity from the grocery store. She had set up an office and a computer and a very resourceful person. Couldn't afford rent on the wages she was getting. Very smart, clearly. But the vice president was in town talking about the economy and didn't mention wages or housing, which when you in the same week have a story come out like that, you know that there's a disconnect between what people are experiencing and feeling and frustrated about and what the electeds are talking about. And so we desperately need them to address what people are saying is their top priority.
No, there is a bit of tone deafness there. I cannot disagree with that. So how do we get them to in this direction? Because look, I think, you know, I've talked to some politicians and I think they want to be in this place. I think they want to make lives better. At least I hope. Is there anyone who's doing this well? Is there anyone out there who's championing this kind of stuff that you go, hey, this is somebody who's doing it right?
I mean, Senator Sherrod Brown has run on the dignity of work over and over and over again in Ohio. And of course, Senator Bernie Sanders has made it his priority to reintroduce legislation to raise the minimum wage every election cycle. I mean, some folks are pretty committed to these issues. And I will say, you know, President Biden and Senator Schumer have all been pretty supportive of these things, no doubt. I just think this year when we are up against the likes of Trump,
yeah,
and if we're worried about that, then we need the White House and anybody running for Senate to address these issues head on first and foremost.
No, I'm right there with you. So let me ask you then, because you beat up on Biden a little bit. And, you know, look, rightfully so on a lot of But the other side, you know, I'm looking at the Republican side. I often say, you know, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Is there any hope on that side? Because, look, a lot of this stuff, given the division that, you know, that we have in this country, we seem to be split down the middle. You're going to need some Republicans to go, hey, yeah, I believe in reward for work. I believe that we should raise the minimum wage. I believed, you know, tipped employees should be paid, you know, a living wage. Is there any movement on the right for this stuff?
Absolutely. And I want to clarify, I'm not beating up on Biden. I am pleading with the campaign to focus on the issue that people have said is their top priority. On the Republican side, look, this is not a partisan issue among working people. You know this. I have been out collecting signatures in very red districts in Ohio, and people with MAGA hats have walked up to me and signed my petition for $15 an hour. This is not a partisan issue among voters. And that's why
among voters.
Yes, when you put minimum wage on the ballot, it passes every single time.
As always, great talking with you. I wish the best, and I hope to see you back here again real soon. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Partly cloudy skies, upper 40s here in the overnight. There may be one or two showers as we get closer to sunrise. The better chance of showers and storms will be during the day Thursday. Mostly cloudy skies, gusty winds at times, highs reaching the middle 60s. It's 60 at our studios.
Do you catch yourself quoting TV shows like that? It could win you a free meal and make you our next star of the day with Culver's. Join the morning show on WFHR every Friday.
What you talking about, Willis?
My name's James, and I'm telling people every Friday we'll play a theme song or a quote from a movie.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give it.
You call 424-2600, give the correct answer, and you'll win a family pack from our Wisconsin Rapids Culver's.
To the Batmobile.
Join the morning show every Friday for Culver's Star of the Day.
I love it when a plan comes together.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
This next story is, for me, a really good one. Look, as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, did not have a lot of books around. In fact, none, really. You know, we didn't have the disposable income for it, which is why my kids, they've got all the books. I mean, we've got literally shelves and boxes and all kinds of books that they were able to read when they were kids. And it helped them. So I'm a big, big supporter of getting books into kids' hands. My wife, when she does the Scholastic Reader things for the local school, it's always about ensuring that a kid walks out with at least one book, which is why over the weekend, when AFT celebrated their 10 millionth book being given away. So we got to get Randy Weingarten on the show to celebrate this, because this is a big, kind of a big deal. And that's why I've asked Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, to come share some thoughts with us. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, Rick. Thank you.
This is kind of a big deal, giving away 10 million books. You know, I got to tell you, I think as I was reading the press release, I was thinking about myself as a kid going, you know, I remember the bookmobile coming into our neighborhood, and, you know, every other week you being able to run and grab something, because we didn't have libraries in the neighborhood either. But I remember that power, that fantasy, that opportunity because of those books. And I think it's great what you guys are doing.
Look, I know I'm not normally without words, but I am, there's lots of things that, you know, we get to do as union leaders. There's a lot of dreams, just like our members, just like parents, just like students. We have a lot of dreams and a lot of, can we do this? What about this? And I just, that story that you told about yourself, it reminds me of the story of this kid in West Virginia who, like 12, 13 years ago, a long time ago, we were handing out probably on our first book distribution, or one of our first book distributions, and we're doing it in school. And I leaned down, and we had like four or five different choices, and he picked one, and I gave it to him, and he said, "I am putting this in my home library." This is a kid from Appalachia, from McDowell County, West Virginia. I'll never forget. And I said, "Wow, a home library. What books do you have in your home library?" The way he said it was so intrepid. And he said, "This is my first one. This is my, but the fact that he wanted a home library and he saw this as part of that, and he saw that reading opens the world." And so for so many kids and families, what, you know, and we started it with first book around the conference room in my office, or the conference table. And we said, "What if, what, can we do this? How about a few? How about 1,000? How about 5,000? And now 10 million books. But what's also so remarkable, Rick, is that my membership has really taken to it. 700 different locals have actually done some book giveaway in the United States in the last 10 years. And there have been 300, before we counted the five this weekend, 384 events in the last 2 years of just giving books away in community, you know, in community, mostly on a Saturday or a Sunday or after school. So we have a community fair, or we have a community night. So as in the last 2 years, as these extremists were trying to ban books and stopping kids from reading about themselves or about other kids, we've been giving out books, over 2 million in 300, almost 390 different events in the last 2 years. I mean, that's what reading is. That's what America should be. That's what engagement in community is, over a book, over literacy, the joy of reading.
No, there are 10 million lives that you've touched. And you look, you know, your members, you know, teachers across this country, you know, I think of, you know, my wife used to do a lot of work with the Scholastic Reader Program at the schools when our kids were little. And we would always give the, you know, our kids' teachers a little bit of money to make sure, you know, which kid wasn't going to get a book. Because I've always been very sensitive to that, you know, having my background of not being able to get, you know, anything from the book list or any of the things to be able to participate in, because we didn't have any money. So we've always been, you know, thoughtful of that. And the teachers have always been, you know, willing to dig into their pockets and ensure that every kid gets something. So while your union's doing this, your members are doing it too, which I think is incredible, because it really is. And I think you've said this a bunch over the years. It really is just about the kids.
Educators want what kids need. They wouldn't be educators. Nobody goes into this work right now without having two things: a love of children and a desire to make a difference in their lives. We can teach a lot of tools and a lot of tricks of the trade and pedagogy and content, but in order to be a bus driver, a paraprofessional support personnel for a special needs class or a special needs kid, to be a teacher of anything, you gotta love kids and want to make a difference in their lives. And, you know, they see the work that we're doing in terms of getting books and distributing them. I mean, they, you know, look, we spend millions of dollars in this endeavor. It's not, you know, first book helps us get books for, you know, a price point that we can afford, but it's millions of dollars to have done this work. It's more than $10 million to have done this work, but it is worth it because of the engagement and the sparking of of imagination and of the joy of reading and the confidence of reading.
No, I mean, the Ray Bradbury books I read as a kid that I got from the bookmobile, those were, you know, those were transformational in my life. So I'm yeah. right on board with you. But, you know, right now we're in a moment where, as you pointed out a moment ago, there are people who don't want kids reading books or pushing yeah. reading. Or and it seems, you know, look, it seems like there's an assault not just on education, but directly on your members and teachers in general. And look, I know we just had Teacher Appreciation Week last week, but I'm looking at, you know, all of these states where they're pushing voucher schemes and they're defunding public education and privatizing and doing all this stuff to try and keep kids, it seems like, and maybe you got a thought, to keep them from reading and educating themselves and yeah. being critical thinkers, 'cause we just want followers.
Look, I think you just nailed it. Why would people, and look, take a guy like Rufo or a guy like DeAngelis or Betsy DeVos or Jeffrey Yass. I mean, Jeffrey Yass, who's spent millions of dollars in trying to balkanize public education and fragment it and defund it from Philadelphia to places in Texas, he got a great education. He got whatever money could buy. Why is he so afraid of others being critical thinkers? Why is Betsy DeVos so afraid of others being critical thinkers? Why does a Rufo who works for DeVos, who works for DeSantis, why would a Rufo say words to the effect of, to get to universal vouchers, you have to create universal public school distrust? Why do they want this? And I would argue, you know, it's part of chaos versus community, fear versus hope. But why are they so afraid of knowledge? Why are they so afraid of critical thinking?
Because I think they would then realize, the people would realize how rigged the game has been for so long, and how the Yazzes of the world and our billionaire class of the world, how they have reaped the benefits of working people's labor. I think you would wake up to that point at some, no?
Yeah, I mean, no, I agree with you, but I think the first question I would ask is why? You know, you and I both have a view as to the answer to that, but I would just say to people who are listening to your show, why? Like, we've toiled in this, and we have watched how regular folks, you know, live in a rigged economic system, and that it's a labor union, it is collective bargaining that helps, you know, unrig the rules. It's like, you know, the FTC just basically saying, no more non-competes for regular folks, non-competitive agreements. You know, it's having the drug companies forcing them to negotiate, you know, insulin prices for diabetics. I mean, so there's a bunch of stuff that we're trying to do to unrig the rules. It's, you know, let's stop the tax cuts for the rich. Like, let's actually try to create a system in America where work is what's valued, not wealth. So I think you and I have a view on this, but what I would just say, that's why I'm just pressing back a little bit and saying, just even asking the question why, like in a world of AI, in a world of technology, it's the application that means something. It's relationships that mean something. It's critical thinking that means something. It's communication skills that mean something. So why books help as a gateway to all of this? And the last thing I would say is this whole argument about divisive concepts. How are we going to help kids learn to navigate their lives, to navigate conflict, if we don't help them talk about conflict?
Yeah.
Like, how? Like, no. And that is part of what you need to learn, you know, as a kid, as an adult. How do you navigate conflict? So this notion of all of these culture wars, banning books, banning divisive concepts, censoring, I mean, like not letting people talk about slavery or its effects. I mean, it feels a little crazy, but I think it is just asking the question and just doing the activity of giving out books as others try to ban it. You think about the strength and the power in that, the power of knowledge.
No, not too long ago, my daughter drugged me to the bookstore, and in the bookstore was a table of all the banned books that they had for sale. And I go, hey, my high school reading list, because that's what it was. I mean, they've banned my education or want to be banning our education, which is how we end up with people like Aaron Rodgers, who has evidently gone from medical expert to history professor. I don't know if you've seen his latest gem that he's come out with. Evidently, he told Tucker Carlson that he wishes Joe Biden knew as much about American history as Vladimir Putin knows about Russian history. And there's so much to unpack in that statement. But, you know, this is what passes for critical thinking.
Well, I mean, you know, what's sad about this is when celebrity, just like Robert Kennedy Jr., actually substitutes for leadership. And that's unfortunately what's happened here. I mean, facts are, you know, I mean, don't get me started on Putin and what he has done. But I wish that virtually any leader in America or the world would have the empathy, would have the courage, would have the sanity, would have the demeanor that that a Joe Biden has, as opposed to someone who actually is trying to create, trying to decimate Ukrainians because of a czarist love that Putin has. I mean, it's a little crazy, but to your point about history, a guy taught AP Gov in New York City at Clara Barton High School. You know, for all those extremists, just check it out. I did teach history in New York City, AP Gov, and I went back. I still have a lot of my lesson plans in my basement, and I went back and flipped through them last summer. And this is in the 1990s, and it's AP Gov, and half of what I taught could not be taught, or a bunch of what I taught, because I taught impact of discrimination. You couldn't teach it in Florida or in Texas these days. And how crazy is that? That they're so afraid of kids actually learning how to be critical thinkers.
Yeah, it's amazing to me.
Let me give you one more example. A book that we gave out this weekend by Matthew Cherry. It's called Hair Love. It's a book about Black kids exploring their hair. And it's been banned in places. Like, why? Again, I'm asking why. What are the extremists so afraid of? Why are they afraid of kids learning about each other? Why?
Well, could it be? I mean, you know, honestly, if your goal is to divide people and keep people pitted against each other, you know, keeping, you know, stereotypes in place, keeping those divisions, you know, firmly in place, that's kind of a necessary tool if you're going to divide and conquer a working class. So there's part of me that gets it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not disagreeing, but the reason I keep on asking the question why is I know there are good people who are really good people across the ideological spectrum. And the way in which people have been, their anger has been pushed and prodded, and, you know, and with all of these so-called threats, it is the autocrat's tool.
Well, I want to give you the utmost credit, congratulate you on 10 million books. I know you're going to continue to go forward, you know, and this fight to keep public education in the hands of we the people and the public is going to continue. Do you have some words of hope, some words of,
yes,
of wisdom, something that can help us make us feel better about maybe we're going to win this fight?
Look, I am all over the country. People want a better life. They want to know who's going to help them. And I think that if we really talk to people, we engage, and we do something that we've learned as teachers, which is meet people where they are, treat them with respect. It's not what's said, it's what's heard. People in America want a better life. Families want the work they do to be rewarded. They want their kids to be happy and to have a pathway to success. And that is what education does. And that is what labor does. And that's why, even with all of this anger and all of this churn, think about what the labor movement has done in the last couple of years. Our union alone, we are up to, from our July 22 conference, July 2022, to now, almost July 2024, we have organized from scratch 160 new places, places where people voted to have a union, where they wanted this opportunity, where they came together to better their lives. We are at the highest level of membership we have ever been at. So there is something about, in this hopey, changey way that I speak, there's something about wanting to actually engage and have a union, be able to bargain, and be able to fight for knowledge for your kids that people in America really want. That's what makes me hopeful. And frankly, I want a president who's going to help make that happen for more and more people, as opposed to a president who's only about himself and only about divide, 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 and create chaos. That's why I'm hopeful.
No, I'm with you. The idea of union job, better life, better opportunities, I'm right there with you. But Randy, as always, I appreciate the thoughts. Thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Want to hear your thoughts. What was your first book? Do you remember? Let me know. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day of the founding of the Library Employees Union of Greater New York. This was the first public library workers' union in the United States. From its beginning, one of the key efforts of the union was the fight for equal rights for women and men in the library field. Maud Malone was one of the leading spokeswomen for the union. She was also an active supporter of the campaign for women to win the right to vote. The union leaders worked to build relationships with other women's rights organizations. According to a report on the first 2 years of the union's activities, the union arose out of the need to remedy the particularly bad working conditions and wages of librarians, especially in the public libraries of the city. The union wanted to improve the promotion system, especially for women. In order to strengthen their cause, the union leaders corresponded with libraries as far away as England, France, Australia, Africa, and South America. These exchanges centered on discussing the library question from the union point of view. Promoting the union point of view to library workers proved to be a tough task. The union tried to convince library employees to think of themselves as workers and part of the working class. The union advocated for library employees to be included as part of the city's civil service system. But many of these workers thought of themselves as professionals. And in the end, this hesitancy to buy into the idea of unionization led to the downfall of the Library Employees Union, which ended its efforts in 1929. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're
listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I love the work that AFT does around getting books into the hands of kids. I mean, over the years, I have seen teachers do amazing things, and thank goodness for our teachers and all the people who take time, spend the hours of their day, their passions, educating our children and really caring for them. Look, our mainstream corporate-controlled media, the right-wing media funded by these attack dogs, it's all about creating division. And this is the weird thing. You know, I've talked to a lot of parents over the years, and it's always this frame of, oh no, we love our kids' teachers. You know, they're good, decent, caring. They're our neighbors. They're the people that we spend time with. They're wonderful. We love them. It's those others. It's the boogeyman teacher out there somewhere, because we've heard. And this is where the right wing is masterful at creating this scenario of, you know, we've got to distrust the other. You know, ours may be okay, and we're gonna stand by ours, but we got to destroy public education as a whole to stop the others without understanding the you're destroying your own as well. So when you see all of this money that's being poured into all of these schemes, all of these gimmicks, all of these, well, oh, ripoffs. What you're doing is you're defunding your own local school. And I look at Iowa. You know, we've had a number of Iowa state reps on the program talking about their voucher schemes, and the money that was supposed to be going to education ends up in the hands of, well, people who are already sending their kids to private schools. Nice windfall if you can get it, but not making education better. Just making the better off better off. I think that's a problem. Now, look, I look at this 10 million books. This is a big deal, because I think about when I was a kid. You know, we didn't have disposable income. There weren't books in the house. I don't remember owning many books until I got to be older. And then, you know, I read a lot of magazines, and, you know, Omni magazine was one of my favorites. But that was, you know, I had a paper route and I had disposable income of my own. When we had kids, you know, my wife is a big reader. I mean, she's every minute of every day, she's got her nose somewhere in a book or listening to them, or, you know, somewhere in that world. So that joy and love of reading, you know, has filtered down to our kids. And thank goodness for her for having done that, because I grew up, I hated reading. I had a nun in seventh grade, Sister Mary St. Leo. Who got me to hate reading? And because again, I think reading is something that opens up worlds, opens up opportunities, gets you to think about things a little bit differently, gets you to maybe entertain other ideas, and challenge your own. I don't think that's a bad thing. And we're in this moment right now where the moneyed interests don't want critical thinkers. They want reactionaries. We don't want people who are able to balance ideas, multiple ideas. It's only narrow-minded, blinded thinking, my way or the highway. Without being able to understand what other people may think or feel or want, or their hopes or dreams, or where we're the same, only where we're different. So good on Randy, because look, I think it's a great program. I think it's a good opportunity to get kids early, because the sooner you get kids reading and loving and being passionate about, you know, exploring new ideas and new worlds, I think the better we're going to be in society for it. Because I think we do need to get pulled back from this, you know, text world, this social media, if it's not 30 seconds, it doesn't exist kind of thing, and really go back to having the ability, I don't know, to really think through some arguments. So good on AFT for the work that they do, and good on the teachers there. You know, I think it's a really important thing that they do to ensure that kids get access to books. And I'll tell you, over the years, you know, as our kids went through elementary school and went through school, we watched as teachers, you know, they dug into their own pockets to make sure that you know, kids had a chance. Had a chance to get a book, had a chance to expand new worlds. And, you know, like I said, from our experience, you know, me, I've always told my wife, give some money to make sure that no kid goes without. I think as a society, it'd be better if we thought that way. I want to hear your thoughts, though. What was your first book? Do you remember? Do you still have it? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.